visual music from La La Land to Screensaver. Now, I don't actually mention Screensavers, but I do. I will start with La La Land. So, some of my good intentions will be carried out. So the La La Land was invented in 1963, and kind of seemed to me to have some sort of influence on the domestic visual culture of the 60s. And although it, in some ways it predated a lot of this kind of stuff, which is, this is Frank Zappa and the Mother's Invention and the visuals by the Joshua Light Show. This is New York 1967. So this is kind of a few years after the magic invention of the lava lamp. But sort of thinking of the lava lamp as a kind of domesticated version of this kind of spectacular that became quite a popular culture in the 60s. So thinking about light shows, I think it's quite easy to make a connection between that and you know, the Wagnerian, hopefully there's no native German speakers in the audience, but Gesamtkunstwerk, the sort of the total artwork. So from Wagner, you know, he presented his operas, he wanted to blow your mind in a kind of, you know, sort of 19th century kind of way. This is kind of a more sort of 20th century kind of way of doing that. And sort of thinking about this immersive environment with the sound, the lights, I guess, you know, everyone's auras kind of coming together. Before this kind of became part of popular musical culture, was something that I've read a lot about and I'm really interested in, but of course never had the chance to experience. This is a picture of two very handsome young men in their ties. This is from the Vortex concerts, and I should turn down those lights a little bit.
That I made this year, an installation called Wet Social Sculpture.
thinking about immersiveness, thinking about these kind of all-encompassing environments, I was kind of a little overlord, and I don't have a bunch of engineers to help me make, you know, distributed sound systems and keyboards or interference projectors, so I've got myself a portable Sparkle. Portable Sparkles have light systems built in, they have sound systems built in, so they're kind of, they have this sort of, they're kind of like a backyard Gesimst Gutsberg in a way, you know, get in there and whoa, you're in another universe. So this show had the Sparkle, you're most welcome to get in there. There's the opening, there's me and some of my workmates and my boss in the corner, she was there as well, what I mean. So I was kind of interested in this sort of amniotic environment, wiring it up, sort of the sound, the disco lighting, and for the sound component I decided to use Whale Song. And kind of thinking about, as a major reference for this, a guy called John Cunningham Lilly, who was a sort of psychological researcher. He explored the kind of blank canvas that the flotation tank provided. So I was sort of thinking about the flotation tank in relationship to this more domesticated spa form idea. Lily, the movie, I don't know if you know the movie Altered States, but the actual imagery in the background is here is excerpted from Altered States. And Lily spent a lot of time in a flotation tank and took quite a lot of acid, took quite a lot of ketamine, and his researchers, as they turned out, were used by sort of organisations ranging from NASA to the Salem Institute to Lilly also admitted that he was part of MK Ultra, which I don't know if you know read all those great websites, but was the CIA's big mind control, Cold War mind control program, and they were going to put LSD in the water and control everybody that way. Didn't quite work out. So thinking about this kind of practice, Lilly was also a pioneering researcher into human communication with dolphins. So he was a man with more than one string to his bow. And his psychedelic enthusiasms foreshadowed the kinds of preoccupations that we would describe as New Age, I guess. His life story spawned two movies, Day of the Dolphin, in which the US Navy tries to turn dolphins into smart bombs with flippers, and Altered States, which was made by Ken Russell in 1980, and which a researcher, played by William Hurt, he uses a sensory deprivation tank and hallucinogens conveniently supplied by a mysterious Indian tribe. And in this process, he devolves into primordial matter. So I took a bit in the movie where he's actually devolving, that's in the background there, and made that sort of into a non-narrative film, kind of thinking about the imagery of Belson, I guess, the still I showed you before. The soundtrack for The Pool was Songs of the Humpback Whale, which was included in the 1979 issue of National Geographic. Some of you may be elderly enough to remember that, I certainly do. It was kind of, if you think about it, it was this sort of little floppy 45 record. So thinking about it as a sort of archaic form of multimedia, you know, nowadays you go, you know, you click on the real player download and the computer starts talking to you, but this was like, get the magazine, go over to the record player, actually carefully tear out the record, proper record from the record, put it on your record player, put on the record, and suddenly you're hearing the whales singing. So I was thinking about this in terms of Jordan Belson, thinking about the way in which those fellows in their, you know, handsome fellows in their meaty suits sort of then became enmeshed in the sort of psychedelic explosion in San Francisco. But the way that they went about sort of investigating these ideas and things like entoptic phenomena, which is the imagery that you see when you close your eyes, and trying to sort of make films that sort of represent meditative states or things, sort of trying to externalise an interior vision, I thought that was kind of quite inspiring. Jordan Belson's work's actually been used in a lot of some mainstream films. He's experimented and sort of just offered up this reels and reels of experimental film to the people making works. I don't know if you remember that extra movie from the 80s, I think. His films were used to depict sort of these atmospheric phenomena and re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. So his work was used a lot to depict things that conventional narrative filmmakers had a great deal of difficulty kind of representing. Sort of interested in psychedelia in terms of the phase of all that sort of ideas as well. Lily spent a lot of time in flotation tanks thinking about, you know, human consciousness. He called human consciousness the human biocomputer, which just sounds great, doesn't it? And came up with all kinds of insights. This is a great one. Up the side is ketamine dosage in milligrams per kilogram, I think. And time on the bottom. So we've got internal reality, extraterrestrial reality, network of creation, and at the top is unknown. So he spent a lot of time in this practice, but he didn't seem to actually gain more. I don't know. This is a diagram for, you know, insights into creation. Give me a mandala any day, I say. So sort of connecting to these ideas of all enveloping environments and thinking about the ways in which they, you know, the sort of antecedents that they have. Another thing that I was thinking about was expo art. This is just an image from one of my shows with the 1967 Biosphere, which was the American pavilion at the Montreal World's Fair on fire. But that's by the way, that happened later. This was at the time, this was in 1967. So, you know, world's fairs, everyone gets very excited. Nations sort of feel this desire to represent themselves as, you know, high-tech kind of Eastern European what's-its. This was the, and they always have great names, the Diapolyserene, which is in the Czechoslovakian pavilion. And it was composed of 112 cubes. Each of those had a slide projector behind it, and each of these images could be independently or as a mass kind of altered. That's another. What the heck is this, I think? Also, at the 1967 World's Fair in Canada, this was a large scale film projection. The work in the photograph is called Labyrinth, and it's by a guy called Roman Coitor. They took 70mm film and projected it vertically rather than horizontally, and they had, in this auditorium you can see, they had multiple screens and 288 speakers distributed around the environment. And this, kind of interestingly, the IMAX system has its roots in Expo 67, in this pavilion. Where multi-screen films were the head of the fair. A small group of Canadian filmmakers and entrepreneurs decided to design a new system using a single powerful projector. IMAX technology premiered at the Fuji Pavilion in Expo 70 in Osaka. So this kind of then became commercialised as the mighty IMAX system, which we know and love so much today. Interesting in terms of IMAX as well, Douglas Trumbull, who was the filmmaker who made the Stargate sequence for 2001, also became heavily involved in what were called event films or ride films, and eventually his company merged with IMAX. So you've got Douglas Trumbull, this abstract filmmaker, this bunch of Canadian entrepreneur filmmakers, sort of turning onto this. This is just to show you how mighty. Sort of working into this, to creating this sort of cinematic environment that was so all-encompassing. This sort of other idea about a programmable environment or an all-encompassing immersive environment. Because the image is so big with IMAX, you have to have really high frame rate, because the actual physical difference between what your foveal or central vision can perceive and what your peripheral vision can perceive in terms of the gaps between the frames, because it's encompassing your peripheral as well as your central vision, you need to have a higher sort of 30 frame per second frame rate, otherwise it starts making you sort of stroke out. So your body kind of responds to this kind of environment in a different way to just a 35mm cinema movie theater, maybe Dolby 5.1 stuff. And I thought it was kind of interesting, it's a bit hard to see, it's just a small little gif, but kind of interesting how the IMAX dome theater kind of evokes to being a little bit thinking about the planetarium and how Belson and those guys were using that space. And as a sort of a cut rate version of this immersiveness, and thinking about programmable and responsive environments, this is a show that I did last year, using a bunch of different elements, mainly the iTunes Visualizer. And I don't know if you're familiar with the iTunes Visualizer, I think Windows Media Player and other players have a similar kind of function, but you take the sound wave and click on a button and it turns the sound wave into this very lava-lampy kind of, I guess what you call, you know, sort of automatic visual music. So I took a story by J.G. Ballard, which is about a house, a psychotropic architectural house. Psychotropic architecture being this idea that buildings respond to their moods and emotions of their owners, and they change form and shape. So in the Ballard story, of course, the house is deeply traumatized by its previous owners and becomes homicidal. So there's a story about this house, and the house is, you know, changing and altering and responding, and this sound wave of a computer, robot computer voice, reading the story to you, then generates this imagery. So there's three data projectors around projecting onto these walls. So once you get in there, it's a pretty immersive kind of environment. It wraps right around you, and the architect's doing there too. So this kind of enveloping environment, I'm never quite sure if they're having a great time or a bad time. This sort of idea of an environment that's sort of influencing you or responding to you kind of brings me back to this idea of music. This is from my album of music, which I have at home. I never listen to it because it's just really dire. But the album cover art is really interesting. Don't know if you can read it, but it's talking about the music mood rating and the stimulus progression, which is what they call this unique rating concept. So they've divided up all kinds of music and beats per minute into their sort of physiological effect on you and scientifically. So this is the track listing. So what the Music Corporation, which is a division of the teleprompter company, which I thought was kind of interesting, since 1934 has pioneered and developed the sound method of humanizing man-made environments. More than 40 years of continuous research, testing and development have brought stimulus progression, practical, inexpensive system for the advancement of areas where people work, shop, and recreate. So they say it's music to be heard but not listened to. To achieve its singular function, music arranges and records its own music to specification. It's available from no other source. Music serves man. Guided by a board of scientific advisors, music serves as helping millions of people internationally to be happier, healthier, more efficient. Children and educational application, handicapped and retarded people, patients and medical staff and hospitals, personnel and offices, banks and insurance companies and workers in a great variety of industrial situations, to name a few. It is not surprising that music by music has been called the sound heard around the world. This album can be purchased anywhere at any price. So this is kind of, I know you've all been in elevators, you all know what music's like. I won't trouble you with the string editions, but I think music's kind of interesting as this sort of pervasive thing, and also interesting because of the responses it stirred up, particularly, I'm just going to read you a little bit from the liner notes for Music for Airports. So this is Brian Eno, who kind of thought about the idea of music and reckoned he had a better idea. The concept of music design, specifically as a background feature in the environment, was pioneered by Music, Inc. Familiar tunes arranged and orchestrated in a lightweight and derivative manner. Over the past 3 years, I have become interested in the use of music as ambience and have come to believe that it is possible to produce material that can be used thus without being in any way compromised. To create a distinction between my own experiments in this area and the products of the various purveyors of canned music, I have begun using the term ambient music. Whereas the extant canned music companies proceed from the basis of regularizing environments by blanketing their acoustic and atmospheric idiosyncrasies, ambient music is intended to enhance this. Whereas conventional background music is produced by stripping away all sense of doubt and uncertainty, and thus all genuine interest from the music, ambient music retains these qualities. And whereas their intention is to brighten the environment by adding stimulus, thus providing supposedly alleviating the tedium of routine tasks and leveling out the natural ups and downs of the body rhythms, ambient music is intended to induce calm and a space to think. So this was in 1978. It's kind of interesting to note that Music for Airports, which is one of Brian Eno's early productions in the ambient genre, was actually used at various airports, and they were due to complaints by people saying it made them nervous and upset, they stopped using music for airports. And knowing the album, I would say it would maybe quite newly get onto it. I think I'd take the theme from Airport 75 instead, say as an example. So he talks a little bit about how he came to sort of come up with this idea of ambient music. He got hit by a car, and while recuperating, a friend of his came and bought some 18th century harp music, and she left the record on, and when she left, he sort of, lying in bed, realised that the record, the level, the amplifier level was really low, and that one channel wasn't really working at all, but because he didn't have the energy to get up and make things better, he continued on with the record playing almost inaudibly. And kind of coming out of that, he thought about hearing music as part of the ambience of the environment, just as the colour of the light and the sound of the rain are parts of the ambience. It is for this reason that I suggest listening to my pieces at comparatively low levels, given to the extent that it frequently falls below the threshold of audibility. So, thinking about soundscapes as maybe records of places, but also then maybe thinking of soundscapes as ways of actually creating structures, which I think is, I guess, an obvious link to Goethe's idea of architecture as frozen music. The physical connections between image and sound were investigated by a guy called Ernst Chladni. I think that's how you say it, I'm not quite sure. He was a scientist working kind of at the turn of the 18th century. I always get confused. He was born in the 1700s, so he was producing his research in sort of into late 1700s. And this is a picture from his manuscript, Discoveries Concerning the Theory of Music. What Chladni did was he had a plate, a metal plate, actually, yeah, and he vibrated it. He used a bow of a violin. This is a sort of contemporary scientific experiment I just stole off the internet. And this is sort of got an automatic vibrating plate, sort of different frequencies there. So he was sort of quite astounded by the fact that these different frequencies of vibration created these different intensities of pattern. This idea was then taken up by a guy called Hans Jenny in the late 60s, who was a Swiss researcher, and he came up with some pretty interesting images. This is Don Giovanni, one of the overtures, being played to a dish of water. And this is iron filings with some high frequency sound going through them. This is my favourite one. This is smoke. So the smoke is coming from jets below, and just woman to the perfection and completion of the sound well. So those are just, I guess, a couple of ways of thinking about, this is going to be the tricky bit. part of the experiment. So I was going to show you this short film work that
enter.
it going back to composts and then spending the time compositing it. So this idea of, I guess for me, kind of connecting the idea of a pathetic fallacy, like the landscape kind